If I step on a butterfly, it could send ripples through time that mean that I'm not even born in the first place, and I could just disappear.
Definitely. I mean, that's what happened to Pete.
Pete?
Your friend, Pete.
He's standing there a moment ago, but he stepped on a butterfly.
Now you don't even remember him.
Welcome to episode 31 of Zero Hour Strikes, the show that covers DC's 1994 crossover event, Zero Hour Crisis in Time. Every issue, every tie-in, every zero issue. I'm Siskoid.
I'm Bess.
And in this episode, we look at the last few comics to come out on Zero Month itself. Wonder Woman, Hawkman, and Aquaman number zero. Still a couple of episodes of epilogues to go, Bass, but this feels kind of like the end of the journey.
Yeah, it really does. It's not the end yet. No.
It's not the end, but it is the end of Zero Month itself.
Well, I think we're ending on a high note.
I think so, too. I mean, they're big names. They're big names. And there are a couple of these that we did not yet cover at all in the 1994 timeframe because they were not tying in with Zero Hour itself. And that's the case with Wonder Woman, if we start with her, because instead he was offering the first chapter of a storyline called The Contest that would ultimately see Diana replaced by Artemis in the role of Wonder Woman. It worked for Superman and Batman. You know, it's Wonder Woman's turn.
Yeah.
To me, this seems like a failure of editorial, or the fact that Zero Hour was not really well planned as that this big an event, because you could have delayed the contest by one issue, or you could have done something that pays homage to the original contest that gave Diana the title. You throw in some Kangas in there, World War II, pantsuit Wonder Woman. I mean, she's got history, a long and varied history, like, you know, like the thing they did with Batman, with the many Batmen. They could have done this with Wonder Woman easily.
Absolutely. And I mean, we're going to get into the comic soon, but it felt kind of like they were pushing to get it, just to get it out.
Yeah, I think so. And also, like this, like chapter two of the contest is what we're going to cover, actually.
Yeah.
It's got a time travel element. There's got a quantum leap moment in there. So,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they could have wrapped this into Zero Hour somehow, or made it touch, you know, more conclusively, but didn't. Issue zero falls between number 90 and 91 of the post-crisis series, a numbering that's going to last until issue 226 in 2006. It was about to become a hot book, thanks to, I think, mostly Mike Diodato Jr., the artist. Mm-hmm. We'll discuss the art once we get into the issue.
Oh, yeah.
And he jumped on for this story. But Artemis is out after issue 100. So it's not necessarily a long arc. John Byrne picks it up, you know, from there. It also changes the status quo, and on it goes with Wonder Woman. If we look at Wonder Woman number zero, it's by William Messner Loebs and Mike Diodato Jr. It's called The Blind Eyes of Time. Do a synopsis. Claiming that Diana has become erratic and violent, Queen Hippolyta announces a new contest to determine who should be Wonder Woman going forward. Diana's a little distressed that the Amazons are excited about this event, but comes to see it as a good. Why not have to confirm her position on occasion? But some Amazons are not invited, like Artemis of the Egyptian Amazons, who recently attacked Amazon Island, and so they are barred from competing, even though they ended up defending Themyscira from demons. They now live as refugees in a camp. Diana visits and finds they worship an idol of Hippolyta's sister Antiope, founder of their tribe, who is a dead ringer for Diana. Suddenly, Diana disappears and is sent back in time 3,000 years to share and relive part of her aunt's life, specifically the time when Hippolyta agreed to marry Heracles and force all Amazons to marry the men of Argos to solidify an alliance with man's world. But Heracles betrays the Amazons on that wedding night, and Antiope is almost killed by her new mate, then hit in the head by Heracles himself when she comes to warn her sister. Suddenly, Diana's back in the present, unconscious and bleeding. Ta-ta-ta.
Yeah, ooh, what a ride.
Let's talk about the cover first by Brian Bolland. He was doing the covers at this point, one of the great cover artists. But do you think this one works?
It's a close-up action shot. I mean, I don't hate it. It's particular. I've never really seen Wonder Woman like this on a cover.
The face.
Well, the face, but everything else also. I mean, a big bullet stopped by the bracer. I mean, it's a big explosion. It's a big... I don't hate it, but I'm not sure how I feel about it.
Yeah, I don't like it. I think Brian Bolland is a great cover artist. and I've loved a lot of his covers, but there's something about that face. You know, she's wincing, she's shouting, she's screaming, like her canine is a little, kind of a little long and kind of looks like a vampire or something. So I don't much like it. It's just okay.
The teeth.
Yeah, there's something weird about it, or the mouth, or it's maybe too close to the nose. I don't know. Not my favorite.
Yeah, I can see. I can see that.
Well, what about the art and the interior? So Mike Diodato Jr. is poised to become like a, you know, 90s superstar in terms of art. And you can see the 90s-ness.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. I mean, every woman pose is a sexy pose. There's a lot of flesh. I'm not really hating it. It's not that it's bad. It's just sometimes it's just a little much. You have to make suits that are also practical, you know.
I think the poses are often, like if we see the full body, I think the faces are generally beautiful. His Wonder Woman has a beautiful face, like beautiful hair. But it's when we see the whole body, they're very often in a pose that is impossible. The waist is too thin, and the butt is out. Butt is out, breasts are out. This is what we mock about a lot of 90s art when it comes to the cheesecake.
I think he was often imitated, I guess, or...
Well, maybe he's imitating someone else. This was the kind of the look. And the fact that the women are so beautiful, like Antiope, I'm going to say this differently every time, but Antiope, Wonder Woman has Antiope on page 17. Where she's just like cradling herself. Here, we don't see the butt. Well, we sort of see the butt. I'm sorry. But but the upper body and the expression, and it's like, it's very beautiful cheesecake. The problem isn't Wonder Woman or her dead ringer or even Hippolyte or most of the Amazons look good. It's freaking Artemis. Artemis herself highlights all his flaws. Her thin head that makes her eyes seem to go around the temples, like a little alien-y. Her menacing breasts, hashtag menacing breasts. her whip-like ponytail that has a mind of its own and is going all around her legs. And it's that, I think, is horrifying. And this is going to be, we don't know this yet, but or maybe we did because we were reading Wizard magazine or something. But you know, she's going to become the new Wonder Woman. And it's, and she's the most 90s extreme, you know, distorted Barbie doll of the lot. So that's not great. But I mean, the rest of the art shows he can do non-extreme. It's just, of all the Amazon shapes and faces and hair that he draws here, because we're on Amazon Island, there's a lot of them. Artemis is the worst. And that's going to become the, you know, she's not even in the book for more than a year, but ugh. And I think that's what we remember of this era. It's like, oh, Artemis.
It's exactly what we remember because I did not read Wonder Woman back then, but I do remember Artemis and the over the topness of it all. So yeah, I mean, she's I guess an homage to that era now. I don't know. It's so out there that. It's so out there that it's kind of cool, but it's always too much.
I thought it was the weakest part, easily. If we go through the issue a little bit, I got kind of stuck on page one.
Really? That's a weird place to be stuck there.
The quote.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so this is like, there's a tradition in comics that you put a literary quote, maybe a proverb, maybe like a song lyric, you know, at the top of an issue. That's frequent. However, in this case, it's a joke, and the credit goes to Daphne Jarvis, says stand-up comedian Daphne Jarvis. I could not find a trace of this person online.
Really?
I could not find a reference to this stand-up. So, I mean, it's 1994. I'm thinking, did Messner Loebs just go to a show somewhere or knew this person? You know, they never made it big. And so...
Maybe.
And so he didn't steal the joke. He gave credit for the joke. I don't know, because if you write that name in, maybe the person changed their name. I don't know. But I can't find anything about Daphne Jarvis. And I also don't think it's a well-constructed joke. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you're a stand-up. What did you think of it?
It's a joke, but...
Let's read it. In the church, they tell us that if we want to get into paradise, we first have to go to a place called purgatory, so we can suffer. I thought God gave that job to mothers. To me, it doesn't work because purgatory is not a job. you know, maybe the delivery, I don't have the delivery, obviously, but I don't think it works as joke writing. And I mean, is it funny?
It's not.
Okay.
There's not much of a surprise. It kind of feels more like a commentary than a joke. Maybe within the context of a bigger bit, maybe?
Probably.
It's not a one-liner, that's for sure. The setup is too long. The punchline is not punchy enough. I mean, there's too, first of all, too many words.
Oh, yeah. Is that something you have to strike out words when you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, efficiency is always the comedian's friend. So saying, I thought God gave that job to mothers, is just too long for a punchline. If somebody would say, in the church, they tell us that if you want to get in paradise, you have to go through purgatory and suffer.
So being a mom.
Something like that.
Yeah, that's my punchline. But my problem, my actual problem with it, you know, it's, it feels so anachronistic. It's Wonder Woman. So yeah. It's like Greek mythology. It evokes myth and maybe literature and poetry. But this strange joke, which is also Christian, like it's Christian cosmology, purgatory, just doesn't fit Wonder Woman, the world. So it just felt odd to me, like ill-placed, and it feels more like maybe it is a friend of Mr. Loeb's, you know, this person. This is an inside joke between us, or it's, this is my friend, and I'll give a credit to my friend and put one of her jokes in there that kind of fits the story, because it's about Hippolyta, really. I don't know. So I got stuck on that page. I'm sorry. Maybe we talked about this too much.
Well, like I said, it's a weird place to be stuck. Page one. Call me Ishmael. I got stuck.
Did you get stuck anywhere?
I actually reread the part where she goes to the tabernacle. I didn't really get that part where the statue disappeared because it was all about the camera angles.
Mm.
I wasn't sure what was going on. For some reason, Wonder Woman and I guess the statue both disappear. And I didn't really get what happened at that moment. And I had to reread the little traveling back in time part.
Yeah, I mean, it's a magical quantum leap. And even when she's inside the body of her mother's sister, she doesn't have agency. She's just reliving those moments. It's like an imposed flashback, but she was actually there so that she can get hurt. And then when she comes back through time, she seems to be dead. I think that's a very effective ending because probably we knew that the contest was about replacing her for, like, maybe temporarily or maybe permanently. Probably Wizard Magazine and previews, and we all knew, like, oh, there's a new Wonder Woman coming. It's probably going to be Artemis. I don't know how much we know at this point. But if you know that, it lacks surprise. You know, stupid comic book journalism. Basically, we know everything and all the twists in advance. So by seeming to kill her off here, now you wonder, oh, crap. Like, is she being replaced because she dies?
Yeah, yeah.
And it turns out that's not the case because after this, Wonder Woman keeps going. You know, you're like Diana puts on a leather jacket and she fights the good fight without her usual tools. And both women are actually in the book. So she's not, it's one of those situations where she's been replaced in the role, but she's still a hero inside her own book. It's not Artemis's book all of a sudden. Diana's still in it. We know that's not going to, well, we know now, hindsight, that, you know, she's not dead here. But I think that's a very effective ending.
It is, because even if I knew that Wonder Woman didn't die and, you know, Artemis was just temporary, I didn't know that. I mean, Artemis is still not Wonder Woman, you know. Even if I knew that, I still was not shocked, but I was like, ooh, what's going to happen? So I was seriously intrigued.
I think Artemis dies in issue 100 or something. So,
oh, poor her.
Yeah, she's probably back. She's probably been back because, you know, all the...
Well, comic books.
Comic books and crises. But she becomes Wonder Woman in 93, not the year, the issue. And then in 100, she's out because she's dead or something. Regardless of the fact that it did not tie into Zero Hour originally, you know, the month before. Messner Loeb still, it's a zero issue and he's still going to retell the origin. Even more so, he goes back in time and starts telling the origin of Amazon Island or the fact that, you know, that story, that actual mythical story where Heracles, you know, betrays the Amazons. And that's why Wonder Woman would be a baby of no man. Regardless of what they decide later.
Is it in the New 52 or was it before that, that Wonder Woman actually became the daughter of Zeus?
I think it's before.
It's from before, right?
Yeah, I think it's before. It's towards the end of that continuity.
There's a little mention of it in this one. They say that Heracles, when he got the, oh my God, what's the names, the mask name there? He tricked Wonder Woman into thinking she was the daughter of Zeus.
Well, it says, it was the most sacred keepsake, for your mother had used it to repel Heracles, turning his own men against him and convincing them all that she was the bastard son of Zeus.
Oh, that she was. So Hippolyta was...
Like Hippolyta was Heracles, and she, like, confused their men. That was the...
Okay. So I read that wrong.
So no, they don't know this at this point.
No. I thought they were kind of winking at it, but I actually read it wrong. Yeah.
The Mask of Proteus.
The Mask of Proteus.
It makes you change it to someone. And they insert it, and I don't know if this is an insertion here or if the origin had been told before about the contest, you know, in this continuity. I don't know. I mean, in the original story, she's wearing a little domino mask and her mom can't tell it's Diana, you know. it's Clark Kent's glasses.
Oh, yeah.
But in this version, she finds the Mask of Proteus that her mom had once used in the legend, and she uses it to turn into this Artemis-like blonde, which is also a little bit extreme, but she turns into this blonde, and then the other Amazons are like, who is this chick? We live on an island. We know everybody. Well, we don't know this girl. I think it's weirder as a result, but she plays a contest in this other form, and so nobody knows it's Diana, because obviously her mother doesn't want her to go to man's world, and she tries to prevent it, and she wins the contest with this look. I'm not a big fan of this version of it. Because then it means that all the contest stuff, it's not Diana. You're looking at this. I think visually, it's like, well, I'm missing the visual that it is Diana doing this stuff.
Yes.
You know, I want it to be her. I don't know when this was introduced, if it's introduced here or if it's probably introduced before. And he must show the contest because there's going to be a new contest to choose a new Amazon. Or it could be Wonder Woman to win again. Why not? But it also shows like the beginnings of the Amazon culture as we know it, or Temiskira's isolation from the world. I thought he played along. He couldn't get into the tie-in, but as a 0 month, you know, he did the job.
Even though I was confused and I read things wrong, I did really enjoy it. I'm going to be honest. The art is very good. I know it's a bit extreme and it's a bit too much, but it's delightful to look at. The close-ups are great. The expressions on the faces are good. I mean, yeah, every Amazon has, you know, long legs and nice thighs, but I mean, they're Amazons.
I have no problem. I actually have no problem with the art. I wasn't questioning the look of it. I was questioning the clarity. I mean, there are elements in here that we're not following this story. So for example, Hippolyta is saying that Diana's gone off the deep end, that she's become violent, that she's been infected by man's world. Is it true? And I was like, I went researching and it's like, but it turns out that Hippolyta is manufactured this reason. She's had this vision that Wonder Woman would die. So that's why Artemis has to die. And and so she doesn't want Diana to be Wonder Woman. She tries to stop this prophecy. And in the end, she can't, but it's not Diana in the role. So it's a loophole, cosmic loophole. So that was like a thing in here. I was like, huh? But within the issue, if you're having to go back, it's like that disappearance where Wonder Woman disappeared. I mean, that whole time travel element is a little bit wonky.
Good thing
there's magic, because otherwise it's like, well, how does this work? Like, I look back at it, and it's also one of the worst pages, because it is Artemis showing her butt and her breasts at the same time shot.
Yeah.
You know, she's crouching inside the panel. It's so awkward. But it's also that's the one where there's like this magical plume. We're supposed to believe that. Well, I don't know. Has the statue disappeared? Is that what they say?
We never see it again. We don't. That's where I'm saying that the camera angles are weird, because Diana seems to be going forward to touch the statue. Right. I'm thinking she touches it and there's this glow of light where we only see Artemis and the other lady. And then everything's gone. Artemis is in this ugly, weird farting pose.
Yeah. But we're just not looking at the statue. I don't think the statue disappears, because the plume of smoke comes from the ground. There's like three steps to get to the statue. That's Wonder Woman disappeared. And we just never get that reverse angle ever again. We're always looking away from the little shrine.
Yeah, but we don't ever see that statue again.
We can't, because the angles are wrong. there's only like two pages that show that are set in the temple at all. So I don't know. I don't think that's much of a...
I'm just saying, if I never see the statue again, the statue disappeared. That's how my brain works.
Okay.
It was a bit confusing, but the ending got me. I think it's really the ending that got
me. Well, here's the question then. Based on this issue and this issue alone, would you keep reading Wonder Woman?
I would at least read the next issue to see if Diana is dead or not.
Okay. I thought you were going to say to see if the statue comes back.
If the statue comes back, yeah, we'd have another episode.
So, yeah, I think I wasn't reading it at this time. Picked it up when John Byrne took over, and it was a mistake. I did not like his take on it. But yeah, looking at this, it's like, well, obviously, if they're going to replace Wonder Woman with Artemis, and Artemis is the character that I have a strong negative reaction to, I don't know how much longer. But if Diana stays in there, I kind of enjoy Diodato's art on this. Not the poses, but the faces and the action, and that all looks good. So,
And I mean, the hair, everybody's hair is great.
Except Artemis. But yeah, I think I would have been, I'd be interested in reading that, like that 10-issue chunk to see where it goes. And I know how it ends, but it looks like an interesting little blip in Wonder Woman's history.
Oh, yeah, big time.
All right, let's move on to Hawkman.
Ooh.
Number zero sits between issues 13 and 14 of the series, but we have to remember it continues directly from Hawkworld, which had gone on for like 3 years. This version of the book, starring a Qatar Hall combined with the Golden Age Hawkman and Hawkgirl and the Hawk God, this lasts less than 2 years. Two more years. It ends with issue 33. The next volume starts in 2002, and it's the one written by Geoff Johns that everyone tends to recommend. Okay. And that one stars the Golden Age Hawkman. It is Carter Hall. So yeah, this version we're about to read kills the character's appeal for a good 6 years.
Oh, wow.
Like, there's a couple of years of this, but after that, I think people were still writing off Hawkman as confusing, and they meddled with it, and like he'd lost his concept. And when he returns, it's really a back to the basics.
Yeah, because I remember the return.
Yeah.
Actually, I do have the return. And I think my disdain for Hawkman comes from this era, actually.
Mm-hmm. Hawkman number zero is also by William Messner Loebs, but also by Steve Lieber and Kurt Schultz. It's called Old Scores. The new Hawkman flies to his friends or former self's friends to learn who he is now. He realizes he has new powers and a new attitude. And then Bad Blood and his gang of Netherworlders attacks to get revenge on him. The fight doesn't go their way, but they escape. Hawkman suits up, picking equipment that pays tribute to past iterations, and flies after them, even though his mother says his destiny is to do something greater than hunting down petty criminals. Empathically feeling the trail through local birds, Hawkman willingly flies into a trap. He massacres his assailants and kills Bad Blood, leaving him to be consumed by his own acid blood. Meanwhile, a mystery villain watches. Ta-ta-ta. Let's talk about the cover.
You might be surprised, but I think the cover is cool. Even though this is not a Hawkman I enjoy, you know, there's a lot of elements that make it cool. The mace, the war mace, you know, on the hip, and the big wings just opened up. And, you know, Hawkman also has probably one of the coolest masks ever.
And here he's also wearing that blade.
The Qatar blade.
Mm-hmm. He's really wearing, like in the issue, we see him pick up ancient weapons, which is kind of Carter Hall or the Hawkman that we think of, and some of the Thanagarian stuff, and like the laser gun, and he's got like ninja stars, and let's, you know, add a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be a composite.
Yeah, and he has a gun. That's the part I went, what?
Well, he used to be like a space cop.
That's when, you know, the whole Hawkworld thing, because I never read Hawkworld. Apparently, it's pretty good. I've never read it. So I knew he was a space cop. So I kind of figured that was from that. To be fair, he does look like a composite. Every part of the Hawkmen of the past.
Backlit by fire. So it is a striking, like he's a very blue painted character. And so the orange in the back. And I think this works.
I agree.
This is one of the few characters actually changed by 0 hour. You know, like he's got real wings and they're retractable somehow.
Yeah.
His eyes and are like cat's eyes, or I guess eagle eyes or whatever. So they're super powered. His memories are sort of different, where he's got like everybody's memories. He's bigger, apparently. He's more distant. Yeah. He's not connecting. He's not really relating emotionally to the people in his life anymore. He recognizes that there was something there, but now he's a bit more aloof. And he forgets them as soon as they're not in front of him, including Shayera. So this is a very different Hawkman that was transformed by Zero. Well, was it? Was it Zero Hour? No, because it was the big Hawk God thing, right? It's like...
Yeah, because when we read Hawkman before Zero Hour, he became the composite at that time. And this new Hawkman was part of Zero Hour. Right.
Yeah. So it's not really Zero Hour. So oh man, it's the Legion and not much else. but it was part of the Zero Hour plan because Zero Hour was supposed to get rid of the JSA.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this was the way they got rid of Hawkman and Hawkgirl.
And to be fair, maybe that whole plot before Zero Hour was linked to Zero Hour, anyways.
I think that was the suggestion was that the Hawk God escaped through the holes in reality. I think that was what we ended up on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But the reality is that even though there's been this big change, Mesner Loebs is basically writing his stories about weird mutants living on the fringe of Chicago. Yeah. And if you weren't interested in that before, what are the chances that you'll be interested in them now? And I thought at first, oh, he kills Bad Blood. Which is like one of these mutants, but they're people with the metagene.
Yeah.
Bad Blood, whenever he's wounded or even pierces his own skin, his blood comes out and it's like tentacles and it's toxic. They kill Bad Blood. So I thought, okay, maybe that's the end of that. That's the way to say new Hawkman, new attitude, new stories. And, you know, who's the villain that's watching from the shadows? That's going to be the next big thing. No, because that villain is Count Viper, who was responsible for the whole Netherworld thing.
Oh, okay.
So we're still in it. I think we're still in it, you know, as long as Mesner Loebs is writing the book, this is kind of the stories that he wants to tell. So the book hasn't changed. There's still going to be this sort of fake Native American kind of... There's still going to be these mutates outside of Chicago or, you know, in the slums of Chicago. It's still... Count Viper is still going to be in it. So it's just a continuation.
I'm not Native American. That element of the story kind of made me uncomfortable. I didn't feel it was racist or anything. I kind of felt like misrepresentation.
In this era, one of the things is that they decided that Qatar Hall, even though he's a space cop, his mother was actually human. She was a Cherokee or something. Now he's just met her. You know, he's been reunited with his biological mother. She's saying, you know, you have a destiny, you're the... And this is all part of the, I don't know, Hawk avatar, or there's something about... It's totemic. And that was a big thing in the 90s. You know, they did that the same thing with Spider-Man at some point, where the spider totem. And you can't just have animal powers. You got to be connected to some sort of... I don't know. If you're Animal Man, it's the red, and it's like, I don't know if it's scientific. It's like the green or whatever. There's a force. But if you got like specific animals, they're sort of saying there's a spiritual totem. There's sort of a connection to a spirit. I think that's what they were going for with Hawkman. And that polluted the character. I mean, the concept of the character. It's like, okay, now he's also got the animal totem and he's got like these powers that are connected to it. That's why he can speak to birds or whatever you want. Like here he sees auras. So it's also New Age. I don't know. But it's just like, let's add more and more onto this Hawkman character. Is he an alien? Is he a reincarnation? Is he... They added so much to him. And then they added this mystical element. And I was like, okay, there's like too much. And then people rejected it. And it was, okay, let's combine everything into some sort of something that we can understand. But it's no purer because it's still an amalgamation of all of that. So it's all in there as well. He's still all those people somehow. So I don't think they corrected the problem.
Oh, no. I think they just added another layer. They just added to it.
I mean, I don't dislike this story per se. Like when he shields his mother, he's got the wrong kinds of wings now. It's like he's still thinking like I've got metal wings. So he actually gets shot up. There's elements here where he's learning who he is again. And he's pretty badass when he actually fights. Okay. Like Hawkman, so needed a new direction. And this is a new direction, but then the stories are the same. You're not really fulfilling the promise of a zero issue.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think you just hit that nail on the head. It's not really different. It's still the same. And I still think that they didn't correct anything from the past. They actually just were just piling on at this point. Although I did think, and I might be eating my words from the past, but I did think that Hawkman was actually badass in this. I know he's a bit extreme because it's the 90s, but I think he's pretty cool.
Well, I was going to ask about page 18, when the dog boy, I'm not sure what his name is, doggy something, the dog-like mutate, jumps him. And Hawkman basically smashes him between his two wings. It's like the guy's trying to rip the wings off and it's like slam. And it's so violently drawn, that and the aftermath. I was wondering, like, did he decapitate this guy? Like, did he kill this guy just by slamming his two wings together?
I don't think he killed him.
Because he doesn't mind killing, because later on he throws a shuriken right in some guy's forehead.
Oh, yeah.
So, and we don't see the dog boy again, like the Wonder Woman statue. He's gone.
We don't see his head. We see his cap, we see his shoulders, his leg, one of his arms, but we don't see his head.
No, and when he, you know, like the next panel right underneath, he's falling back and he's falling on his head, or is he falling on his neck and there's no head? You can't tell. The cap is still in the air. You know, I would have loved to see Steve Lieber here, the artist, actually do Hawk World, you know, because he's got a style very reminiscent of Tim Truman, who did Hawk World. But all the shots, it's not retelling the origin because we're in the origin, but we do see the past. You know, it's like it's doing its zero-issue job of recapping a little bit. And every time we see Hawkman in the Hawk World armor, it looks so cool. So I would have liked to see Steve Lieber actually be able to do stories in that style rather than, I mean, it must have been painful to have to draw all those feathers. Because they're very rendered.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. So I'm not saying it's bad with the new look, but I really like when he's drawing the older armor.
Yeah. And the armor has a certain style that you believe in, that space cop type. Because I do enjoy the space cop look and the metal wings and everything. Yeah, I agree. It would have been cool.
Would you have continue to read Hawkman now that he's cool?
You know, I probably would have picked up a couple other issues, yeah.
Okay. I was reading it at this time. I don't know when I dropped it, but I think I was still reading it at this point, so I'm not too sure. Looking at it now, yeah, I've always been a fan of Hawkman. Not like you, where I need to be convinced. But I do think this franchise is going down, and it's going down hard, and they haven't fixed the problems. So I might have been pretty frustrated at this point.
You think that the comic book would have gone the doggy Bill way, getting smashed between wings?
I mean, it's going to last another almost 2 years. It's not the storyline that killed it, but wherever we're heading, it's too late to change course at this point, because this was your chance. Like, we've said this often enough with different series. Like, this was your chance to save the book, and the people involved were not ready to do so, didn't have the talent to do so in some cases, didn't have the vision to do it, were taken unawares by the zero-hour crossover event, could not turn that into a new direction. And those series died. You know, the proof is in the pudding. It's like, well, you didn't change anything. You kept the same people working on it in the same kind of direction, and all the changes were cosmetic in the end. So this is the case with Hawkman. It's not going to be a success. But we are going to look at a success in our next issue, which we'll broach after the promo break.
Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast. A monthly show chronicling the adventures of the JLI era by Keith Giffen and JMD Mateus. We started with the very first issue, and our coverage goes all the way through breakdowns. We're going issue by issue in release order, tackling two comics per episode, both a Justice League America issue and a Justice League Europe issue. Now, along the way, we're also taking time out for special episodes covering the quarterly book, interviews with various comic book creators, discussing the plethora of spin-off series, cartoon appearances, the infamous TV pilot, and more. And when we're all done, we'll wrap up our coverage by looking at the 2003 and 2005 stories, formerly known as the Justice League, and I Can't Believe It's Not the Justice League. So join me in an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we celebrate your favorite JLI members, such as...
Batman.
Martian Manhunter.
Captain Atom.
Fire.
Ice.
Rocket Red.
The Flash.
The Elongated Man.
Maxwell Lord.
Elrond.
Power Girl.
Renard Russe. I mean, Crimson Fox.
Guy Gardner.
Metamorpho.
Booster Gold.
Blue Beetle.
Nort.
Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast. Part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Want to make something of it?
We're back and continue our discussion of the last comics from Zero Month. With Aquaman number zero, I promised a hit. Aquaman is another book that did not tie into Zero Hour because it just started. Number zero falls between number two and three of this fifth and soon to be very popular volume. Once again, we might say that Zero Hour has been ill-planned. Aquaman could have started with number zero, but in this case, writer Peter David manages to redefine the character, really starting with this issue. It's still a big change for the character. You know, like the writing and the attitude and the feel was there for the first couple issues. But in number zero, you know, we see, okay, now we're going to get a different kind of Aquaman. He won't get his new look here yet, but David's run on what people call the pirate Aquaman will last some 4 years and have a big impact on the character beyond that, including in alternate media. I mean, this is going to be the Aquaman we get in the movies. He's always going to be losing a hand, you know. I think the Justice League cartoons or the Superman cartoon, whichever, made him lose a hand. It was because of this. Peter David, leaves with issue number 46. The book doesn't end until issue 75 in 2003. And I think there have been many several more volumes since. So like it or not, this series is really responsible for modernizing the character and keeping him in the public eye as something other than a joke, or at least the Muggles. I'm not saying that comic book fans think of Aquaman as a joke or ever did, but Eddie Murphy, you know, was making jokes in the 80s about Aquaman. So I think that's what the imagination of the people was. What you need to know about the previous issue, Aquaman just got his hand eaten off by barracudas controlled by the villain Charybdis, who has also injured Aqualad. The two heroes did manage to free the forgotten hero Dolphin from his clutches. However, this is when we come in. But Aquaman number zero by Peter David, Martin Eglund, Brad Venkata, and Howard M. Shum. Hopefully I said those right. It's called A Crash of Symbols. Dolphin brings Aquaman and Aqualad to Atlantis so they can get medical attention. Garth is going to be fine and is soon horn-dogging on Dolphin. But Aquaman is delirious and has many portentous nightmares that obliquely address his backstory and lack of commitment to either the surface or ocean worlds. Fish start to congregate around his sleeping form and they create a water spout that brings him back to his aqua cave. There, he affixes a harpoon to his stump and proclaims it as a symbol of how the sea can use the surface world's weapons against it. Ta-ta-ta!
Yeah.
The cover kind of spoiled it.
A little bit.
He's got the harpoon on the cover. But do you like this one?
This isn't the first time I've read it. I've read it a long time ago. I did enjoy it that time. I read it when, you know, I remember when Aquaman lost his arm and everything. I did remember this comic book, but I didn't remember how this comic book is a horror movie. Mm. The nightmares this man is having it's crazy. It's a wonderful ride. A lot of Aquaman's delirium and how he's, you know, torn between worlds and how he can't really trust anybody and how he's basically alone all the time. And it's big. It's big, and I really, really did enjoy it.
Like, his dreams are weird because there's an awful lot of being consumed by women. Yeah, you know, like all the women in his life show up and they're monsters and they start eating him or something. So I think it's supposed to speak to his lack of commitment to the women in his life, to Mera, to whoever, Dolphin, and perhaps in the future. Like, there's his mother or ancestor in there as well. It's always like turns out creepy like that, but he's just been eaten. I think that's also that's the, you know, when you're dreaming of things that maybe happened during the day or that you saw during the day. What just happened? He just got his hand eaten off. So he's dreaming of being devoured.
Exactly. And I think the dreams in this book It's kind of a weird synopsis of how he felt during the last, that little bit before he loses his hand. You know, instead of just recapping, we went into his feelings and how he lived this. And, you know, at the end, he shows off that hand or that hook for the first time. You know, and he says, is this too much? I actually heard Jason Momoa's voice, you know.
Okay.
We didn't get a recap of what Aquaman was up to until now. We have a recap of his emotional status during the last months or years or since the beginning. This weird snap in a new attitude.
Yeah, because we're seeing Aqua Baby and, you know, his marriage fell apart and his mother went out of the ocean and mated with a human man. And that's all in there. It's just represented as nightmares. So I like this take because we've seen so many origins, some of them good, some of them not so good. But this take is unusual. And I think one of the things about Peter David when it comes to crossover events, I mean, to me, is that he's always been very good at playing with the imposed theme, but kind of doing his own thing or his own twist. This follows the theme. The issue starts, the first word in the issue is zero. So you know he's playing the game. But yeah, like Aquaman is also going to be the comic with the best tie-in for Genesis, which is a horrible crossover event. That one issue, which is all you're in the head of a parademon. Like, so that's one of my favorite issues from the Peter David run of Aquaman. And it happens to tie into something that everybody wants to forget and have, Genesis. Like, even his Star Trek novels, they're famously, he's always combining ideas. You know, it's going to be the relationship between Riker and Troy when they first met, but it's also going to be the Guardian of Forever. It's going to be the Space Cigar or the Doomsday Machine and the Borg. And it's like he combines these ideas together, Trelane and Q or something, you know, like looking at continuity and how to adapt them in an interesting way. And he also brings a lot of humor to it. So I think when you hear Jason Momoa's voice, regardless of how, you know, look at the cover, look how badass and mean this Aquaman is, you know, there's a line in here in the dream he's told, "You're a nice guy. There's no room for that anymore. It's 1994. You know, it's like, we can't have happy sea cop. You can't have that."
Yeah.
Peter David is almost like I wouldn't be surprised if he was told that, you know, by an editor or something. He decided to put in the book. It's like, well, we have to change Aquaman, make him relevant to this decade. He's going to be mean. He's going to be Wolverine because he's got a blade on his hand.
Yeah.
But he's also going to be kind of wry and funny. And so the book is going to have a sense of humor because Peter David usually does in his work.
It's such a good take on this character. I mean, this take charge, you know, no messing around Aquaman is such a better character.
And they're going to refine it because he's going to get that armor. He's not going to be wearing the orange and greens. Wow. He's going to change the harpoon for the like a multi-purpose blade thing or like a hook, more of a hook.
Yeah.
But it can spin, it can drill, it can throw a line, you know, like he gets a little more gadgety as a result. So they're going to refine this basic idea. Like here, it's kind of gruesome with the bandage.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's smiling in that pic, you know, like that final page. Do you think it's too much? He knows it is, you know, but...
Yeah.
And he's been inspired by the dreams, really. You can't be of two worlds. Oh, no, I can't be of two worlds? Hold my beer. Hold my beer because I'm missing a hand. You know, no, I mean, he's kind of laughing at this predicament. This is a pretty traumatic experience, but he's going to turn it into something. And we're starting to see the cast as well, because he's going to have a pretty big cast in this series. And like Dolphin is being added to it.
Yeah.
Undersea heroine of little note up to that point, really.
What happened to Dolphin? Because we don't really see her anymore. And I think she was kind of big in that moment.
Yeah, well, she was part of this cast. And there was also like an illegitimate son, Koryak. I feel like that's in the Jason Momoa portrayal because he's like Aquaman had this Inuit lover and Koryak is born of that. He was born with Aquaman-like powers. And he becomes part of the cast. So we get like a big undersea cast of heroes. It's a little bit like Flash. You know, you like Flash. Flash had like this Flash family. And Aquaman's going to get his own Aquaman family in here during this period.
The Aquafam.
Okay.
Hashtag Aquafam.
There's a dolphin the animal, who predicts, who can smell it in the water, I guess. He predicts that Aquaman and Dolphin are going to be a couple. And they will be. So that dolphin was right.
Yeah.
There's one scene in here that I didn't mention in the synopsis, but I want to mention it now. It's the bit where, you know, they're all worried about Aquaman and they don't know if he's going to make it. And they're walking through the streets. There's just like a little kid who says, Aquaman saved my life, or really spared my life, yeah, as the story goes. Yeah. And he tells the story to Dolphin, who is outraged, although Aqualad gets the joke. Like, these Atlantean kids are tough because they're playing catch with urchins.
Yeah.
And then the kid, you know, tries to catch an urchin, falls back, hits Aquaman's leg, and he's the king, I guess, at this point. You know, Aquaman and Vulcor going, well, what's the penalty for stumbling into the king? It's, oh, I think it's the death penalty. Oh, well, we're, you know, and at the end, we're just going to let you go. And the kid thinks, I was spared. I was spared, but there's no way Aquaman, obviously, you know, you can tell they're ham acting it up, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But the
yeah.
kid believes it. I like this little story because it shows, like, we're still doing flashbacks. This is the one flashback that is not a nightmare, and it kind of yeah. shows the humor that is part of the character, I think. A kind of cruel humor, maybe, you know?
Yeah.
Tough
yeah.
love humor. But there is humor there, and, you know, Aqualad's laughing at it. We're getting the building blocks of what this series is going to feel like. A little bit more horror-y, a little bit more edgy, a little bit more funny than we've seen with past Aquaman portrayals.
I mean, I'm all in. I love it.
This is really a post-Zero-Hour series, and it's not Zero-Hour that changed the character, again, but at least it feels like, oh yes, now we're moving into a new era. And some people don't like the pirate Aquaman, and so that's why they call it that.
It's fine. Even if you don't like pirate Aquaman, you the new Aquaman, the non-passive Aquaman, the non-joke Aquaman, still stayed.
You're right. Like, today, Aquaman is in the origin green. Sometimes has a beard, sometimes doesn't have a beard, you know. But he feels like he's this Aquaman.
Oh, all the time. And the orange and green looks cool now just because of the attitude. That's all it took.
But, I mean, they tried to revamp him, you know, in the 80s. They tried to put him in touch with the mystical world of Atlantis and, like,
yeah,
and
yeah,
the
yeah.
suit, like, you know, the camouflage suit. And that was a very interesting miniseries. But was it sustainable, you know? So it felt always like we were at a starting point with Aquaman after the 70s. You know, after he lost his own series, what were we going to do with this character? And I think here they finally found something.
Not everybody loves Jason Momoa as Aquaman also. I mean, Momoa has his flaws as an actor. I like him. I think he has the attitude that's right for this character, and to not make him a joke. Even though, you know, spoiler alert, there's a joke about him in Peacemaker. Yeah. But the Aquaman character, this attitude, this don't mess with this guy attitude, stays, was relaunched many a times afterwards. So,
and it was solidified, I think, by his presence in JLA. Because in JLA was this character. Even if you didn't read Aquaman at this point, those stories really were very popular, and people would go, okay, well, this is Aquaman. And that yeah. kind of stayed, the bearded Aquaman. I either have even like a funny Aquaman, like a silly Aquaman from Brave and the Bold, he's got the beard.
Oh, man, I love that Aquaman.
it's a great Aquaman.
It's a great take on Aquaman.
The pirate Aquaman, but the attitude is completely other. It's like no other portrayal of Aquaman.
Yeah, but it still works, though. It's so bold and brash and out there, I think it works. I'm just a fan.
It's just a show that, and I mean, that's not the Batman that people expect either, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so it's closer than the Batman 66. Some of these characters, and I think Aquaman is one of them, can survive big shifts, big changes, big different personalities attributed to them, and it still seems to fit the character. And that's true of Batman, and it's true of Aquaman.
Yeah, 100%.
I think we've answered the question, would you continue to read Aquaman after this point?
Oh, it definitely became a fan after this point.
Same. So we're going to take another break, and when we come back, your feedback on our previous episode.
Attention, attention all personnel. New from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, it's MASHcast. Hosted by MASH mega fan Rob Kelly and a rotating cast of VIPs, MASHcast analyzes, episode by episode, the greatest television series of all time, MASH. Find MASHcast on fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Jocularity, jocularity.
Letters lost in time.
Letters lost in time.
Excerpts from your comments on our coverage of The Outsiders, Catwoman, and Robin number 0, some Bat Family titles. Captain Entropy highlighted what was really a coincidence. He said, great to hear two guys from the second largest country in land area discuss Two-Face on 2/22/2022. And on a Tuesday, if you want to do that pun, I didn't do it on purpose, obviously.
Yes, we did.
You know, it just fell in the schedule that way. No planning. But he does offer quick reviews as well. He says, Outsiders issue, dumb, muddled, and boring. The portrayal of Batman always ruined the Outsiders for me, but they aren't better without him. Catwoman issue, well done, but too depressing to enjoy. It really is Dickens, but nice art. Robin issue, outstanding, always loved the relationship between Dick and Tim, and Bruce is humbled and is at his most reasonable here. Really nice art. David Gutierrez calls this version of the Outsiders generic ink, makes a point. Diablo Frank says he roots for the Outsiders, if only because they're not the Justice League. One of the many curses visited upon comics by Brian Michael Bendis was the New Avengers. Marvel basically ripped off the original Justice League by throwing all of their most popular IP onto the team, regardless of logic. And now every team is the Avengers. All of the Defenders are Avengers. Most of the X-Men are Avengers. Hell, the Midnight Suns and Angela are Avengers. And then the Justice League did the same thing. We're living in the Demolition Man future where all the restaurants are Taco Bell, except every comic is Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, the X-Men, the Avengers, and Justice League. Yeah. But at the same time, your average DC fan wouldn't remember or care to add the Outsiders to a top 10 DC teams list. Kevin Nolan painted a cover and drew an entire annual. Jim Aparo, Alan Davis, Paul Pelletier, Tom Rainey, Matthew Clark, and Philip Tan were all series regulars. Brian Boland and Travis Sherrist did covers. The book has Batman top billed more often than not. A great many valuable resources have been expended on Outsiders for them to never really happen. The Outsiders are so very, very fetch.
Stop trying to make fetch happen.
I mean, I don't know about a top 10 team. But then again,
it is, because then this launched a discussion on the at fireandwaterpodcast.com about who we consider DC's top 10 super team IPs, you know, because there are very many versions of Justice League or whatever, but IPs, you know, there's Justice League is an IP, regardless of how many teams you want to add to that.
Are there even 10 teams?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
And whether the Outsiders managed to place in that top 10. And several listeners chimed in. You can check it out. Nobody ever mentions the Outsiders. Like, the Outsiders don't, like, nobody gets to 10, because by 10, you're talking about the Metal Men and, you know, talking about, like,
yeah,
like these little teams that aren't big IPs, but that you love more than you do the Outsiders.
Exactly.
Justice League, Titans, Legion, they all come before, well before the Outsiders. Nobody names the Outsiders because they are kind of a generic kind of team. Obviously, Tim Price didn't chime in because we know he would have said Outsiders. No Outsiders fans or stans came in to say that Outsiders were in their top five. So no, especially not this version, obviously. I mean, if you're going to name Outsiders that you like, you're going to talk about the original team.
I mean, it's horrible.
Frank also says he liked Catwoman number zero, especially the walking back of the prostitution angle. Doug Mensch tends to be one of my favorite Catwoman writers, handling her well under multiple incarnations across decades. It speaks to the lack of priority that the book was written round robin by the Batman office rather than have it its own dedicated scripter for years. But he resented Two-Face being billed as Dick Grayson's villain in Robin number zero, since it was Jason Todd who really had a history with this villain. It seemed to be forgotten as soon as Prodigal wrapped up anyway. Chris Franklin defends the decision, reminding us that Dick Two-Face, that flashback that we saw, was actually from Batman year two, admittedly also written by Chuck Dixon. And it says the Dixon era of the Bat titles is a personal golden age for him. This issue did oddly focus on Dick instead of Tim, but the Bat offices had just got Dick back from the flailing Titans office. Thank goodness. And you could just feel them ramping up his importance across the titles. Make him Batman and soon give him his own series as well, right? As Nightwing. On that note, we have to mention that Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page. If you like our content, please think about making a one-time or a monthly donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards, get on the zero list while you still can at patreon.com/FW podcast, just like these folks did. They got on the zero list. That means they are going to escape the cataclysmic time wave that's coming from both ends of history. Jim Bal has been saved from Baker Street, the moment Batman broke the universe by teaming up with Sherlock Holmes. David Capone has been saved from Bloodhaven as Kemo reigned on the city. Michael Bailey has been saved from the year 2001, which we hear is when Armageddon hits. Diablo Frank has been saved from the Blood Reed, which will teach him to preach on behalf of the Blood Pack. And Spindrift Games has been saved from an Earth where they were raised in the USSR. A reminder that you can leave comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also follow the Facebook page. And on Twitter, the account is FWPodcasts.
Next time on 0 Hour Strikes, Booster Gold, Impulse, and more.